there's still an expectation on God's part of works, but not so much to earn salvation, but to be a light to the world, to show others that we are his images and stuff like that. It also brings to light, well, does that mean we have to like follow all of the law and stuff like that? I mean, it brings the law into it and this concept of being perfect. And that's where I had also read, and I think in Galatians, Paul talks about this idea that he's not calling us to be perfect. He's not even calling us to follow the law anymore. It's just that it's where you get into the fruits of the Spirit and mm-hmm. how those things are supposed to be evidence that you are living according to his purpose and design. Welcome back to the Rheology Podcast. Rheology is a nonprofit ministry that is centered around rethinking, researching, and rediscovery, a process that dives deep into the depths of an intimate partnership with God through a concept Jesus initiated called ecclesia. We strive to cultivate an environment that is not only safe to question and seek, but also one that is founded on the truths of partnership, words of hope that were uttered from the lips of Jesus himself. So in this podcast, we'll question Christian tradition, we'll investigate God myths, and we'll listen to those who are stirring, questioning, and desperately seeking more of what God is doing in and around us each day.
Hey everybody, this is Scott Johnson with the Rheology Podcast, and that's Brandon right over there. And there he is. Today we're going to do a little kind of mini-series thing we've been talking about. If you have noticed, maybe you've not. If not, go back, check it out. But we are in this season of doing these interviews with people who are starting to question, like, maybe as simple as, like, why do I believe what I believe? Or maybe in the realm of, like, Christian religiosity, why are we doing what we're doing? And we call those things the stirring stories. And so Brandon's stirring story was released literally just a couple of weeks ago. And during it, he had mentioned, writing down some questions that you had and stuff like that. So Brandon and I actually were like, hey, you know what? This would be a good little mini series to talk about some of the questions that people might have when they are in the middle of their stirring process, trying to, dissect God, go a little deeper with God, which is a great thing. So we thought we would do that. And we're going to do that all the while drinking a cup of coffee. So this is my cup of coffee right here. Shout out to Magic Morning Bakery in Bedford, Indiana.
Shout out to Hitherto Coffee, Greenfield, Indiana.
What are you drinking there?
It's just black. Straight up. Well, black with a little bit of half and half.
So okay.
I've got
Is it a down. Certain type of roast?
It's a medium roast. Okay. So yeah, it's pretty cool. Coffee shop, local coffee shop to me, owned yeah. by a couple of friends that go to church with us. So it's, I pretty much work from there nowadays.
Yeah. That's like fantastic. And you find those places that like your second office.
Yeah.
I'm drinking a Kicking Horse. It's a brand. It's an all organic brand. First of all, this is a disclaimer here. I'm a decaf coffee guy. I don't really drink a lot of caffeinated stuff. I know. You're one of those people that's like, what's the point? But for me, I don't need caffeine. Trust me. I got plenty of caffeine naturally flowing through my body. I need something that sucks the caffeine out of my body. But
I'm relatively new to the coffee game myself. I didn't drink much coffee at all until the last few years when I started my own business. And now I feel like I need it.
So. I need it. Yeah, Robin, my wife, is like the coffee snob. She drank coffee for a long, long time. And so I would play around with it, but I just got to the point. Yeah, same thing. Last couple of years, I was really growing a taste for it. Yeah. So this is Decaf Kicking Horse. And it's one of my favorites right now. And I grind it up myself.
Ooh, fancy.
I put it in. We just use a Keurig because we don't drink enough coffee to make a whole big deal.
Yeah. But well, I pay somebody to grind it for me. So
there you go. All right. Brandon's got a bunch of questions that he sent over to me a lot. And I thought maybe you could like lead this part of it and we'll kind of go from there.
Yeah, my first, like you said, I sent over a list of, this is something that I've been doing since what I consider to be my stirring moment, which was earlier this year, 2024, and really started to dive deep into the Bible at that point and have been doing so for the last several months at this point. And throughout that, I've just started jotting down questions as I went along and have accumulated a ton of questions and finding answers to them as I go along. But some have stuck out as needing some additional explanation, which I'm hoping to find at some point. So yeah, I like the idea of this series to see if it can help point me in the right direction, if nothing else. So one of the questions on that list, the one that we're talking about today, was this whole concept of salvation and what exactly salvation means. And even more specifically than that, I've been reading a lot of Paul's letters, and I came across a passage in Philippians chapter 2, verse 12, where he says, he instructs us to work out our salvation with fear and trembling. And that caught me off guard a little bit. I wasn't really sure what to make of it. I'm starting to wrestle with what it means, and I think I have a little bit of a better handle on it. But that one struck me as particularly important and challenging. So that's kind of the topic of today's show.
Yeah. Well, it is challenging. You and I have talked about this. This is something we've talked about on the podcast for several different times, is that, we still use a Bible translation. Most of our Bible translations right now are primarily based off of one epic translation that happened in, the 16th century. That's, that's 500 years away.
1500s.
So that's a long time.
Yeah.
So that epic translation was epic because it really, really was. And it was translated by a guy named William Tyndale. And so, William Tyndale is known for a lot of things, but in reality, he was like a genius. Like he spoke like six or seven different languages fluently. He had a desire. He learned Greek. He was a priest in the Church of England. And working his way up the ladder and all that kind of jazz, but super, super incredibly smart dude. And, set out to like, hey, it's this kind of crazy that where the Bible's in Latin and no one speaks Latin. Most of the priests don't even speak Latin. So a lot of times when they would actually read from the Bible, it would be stuff that they had memorized. So they were very ill equipped to like actually help decipher what that meant. So we're still using, so his thing was epic. There was no doubt about it. He basically changed the English language. He modernized the English language, and certain people like Shakespeare and stuff like that all pretty much took notice. And I mean, he just changed culture. He changed language. Unfortunately, we're still using Tyndale's language now.
Is this was the King James version or no?
No. It was the Tyndale Bible, which was just a New Testament. So the King James came a couple of decades after that, but King James is pretty much founded on Tyndale. Yeah. We're talking about a language that definitely was revolutionized and an epic, incredibly, incredibly epic, translation, to the point where, it's like, do you remember the first time, like you maybe read out of the Message Bible?
Yeah.
And you're dude, you're like, wow, that's cool. I mean, yeah, it's poetic. It's cool. It's fresh. The language is like modern. It's like someone's just speaking, talking. It's like,
it was funny. The first time I heard that was when you were leading a retreat that you held for our church back when you were in Indiana. And I think back then the Message was just the New Testament. I think they started out as just Testament, and it has since expanded to the entire Bible. But yeah, I remember that blowing me away when you first read out of that.
Yeah, I think that's like Tyndall's version that did that to people. And the thing is like it was pocket sized so that people could, and it was illegal, obviously, but it got snuck into England. And people, it was pocket sized, people could like literally anybody could just like put it in a pocket or hide it. They can conceal it very, very easily. And it blew everybody's minds. And because this is the first actual English translation that was translated strictly from the Greek and not from, you know, Latin. And it was not, you know, okayed by the higher ups and the authorities and all that jazz. So you know, he was hunted down and all that kind of jazz. But so we're still using, nothing against Tyndall. Tyndall was the deal. He was the man. But we're still using some of the stuff. And salvation is literally one of those words. Like he's got a whole bunch of phrases that you can Google, you know. You can Google him and find out that he's got a lot of different phrases that he created that we use or the Bible uses. And, so we are still using his phrasing and stuff like that. And a lot of times we use it and we don't really know why. We don't know where it came from. We just kind of use it and throw it around. So salvation is definitely one of those, in my opinion, like a very tricky, tricky word, because it makes us think of, you know, paired with a theology, and we'll get into this in another episode, but paired with another theology of like, you know, eternal destination, right? We'll get into that, like I said, later, because that's a whole nother deal. But paired with that, the word salvation literally makes you feel like you're in a crashing plane and Superman swings in and he gets underneath the plane and he lifts it up and it helps land the plane safely.
Yeah, it's also one of those, you know, classic church words. I mean, you rarely hear it outside totally. The context of the church. I mean, occasionally you'll hear others talk about it, but yeah,
right.
It's one of those words that it's lofty in its use usually, and it's hard to picture outside of this context.
Yep, totally. And because it is that, then it also tends to be very, irrelevant to the world around us, right? It sounds super lofty, like you said, religious, and not really applicable to us. So I think we're going to look into this. We have to our foundation has to be an understanding that this is a word that was used, you know, 500 years ago, 600 years, you know, ish, 500 ish years ago. And it was revolutionary then, but not so much now. And so for me, as you well know, I always like to look at the core root words and stuff like that. So we look at the Greek, but honestly, we really probably need to go into the Hebrew, because the reality is that the concept of salvation, you know, this religious concept, didn't start in the New Testament. It started in the Old Testament. And the Jews were the ones that would really start to like live their world around this concept of salvation. So I thought we'd look at the Hebrew word. And the Hebrew word is Teshua, which it makes you think of Yeshua. But I'm probably running through it very quickly. It's actually Tesh. Ooh, and Yeshua is Yeshua. So sounds similar, but they don't look the same. Primarily in Isaiah 46.
It is crazy. Sorry. It is crazy. The more I'm diving into kind of this, looking at the Bible in this way, where you dive into the word analysis and stuff like that, it is crazy how so many of these things line up. It's like, it's just incredible to me that the Hebrew word for salvation is essentially the same as, or very similar to Jesus, because I mean, you see that so often in different phraseology in the Old Testament and stuff like that. It cannot be a coincidence, really.
Well, do you know what, Yeshua means?
Maybe not.
Okay. Means God saves. So therefore, the word saves is in there.
It's got a similar root.
Yep, it makes sense. So Teshua is salvation. It's the act of saving. I look at like Isaiah 46. Isaiah is obviously one of the big dogs in the prophetic world, right? He's one of the big prophets. as they call them, you know, the major prophets. He's not a minor prophet. Don't mistake him for one of those guys. He's a major. And he's basically writing on most of his writings in the Old Testament in context during Babylonian captivity. So the Israelites, all of them now at this point, have been taken into captivity by either Assyrians or the Babylonians. And they're all pretty much been scattered. And a lot of them are over in foreign territory, right? So they're not at home anymore. The kingdom of the old glory days is gone. They're singing Bruce Springsteen for sure, trying to remember the old glory days. You know, but this is kind of the context. And so Isaiah in Isaiah 46 is really talking about, he's trying to like, all prophets are, they're just trying to relay a message. God's telling them and they're relaying the message. And so what he's telling these guys is the idea that, that God will provide salvation. And this is this would be a common idea and mentality for these guys, that God is going to save them, because this is something that their ancestors have heard for generations and generations and generations. And God has done that. He's proven that a lot of different ways. And he would save people, his people, in ways that, well, like we said, like the plane is crashing and he needs to come in and save the day, you know, like them being in Egypt all the way in back in Exodus, right? I mean, he did make a plan and he got a guy went over there, God helped him get out and they got out. God saves, you know, so, and he did a lot of those different things, but that can't be confused with the overall like mentality of salvation as far as the Jews is concerned, because salvation was really a way of life and not just a couple of highlights that they would like relive and relive and retell after forever and ever. So the word in Isaiah 46 is primarily just it is Teshua, and it does mean deliverance, you know, but its root meaning though, is, yeah, there it is, you know, I bring near my righteousness, it's not too far off, and my salvation will not delay. And this is, again, this is probably supposed to be something that might like make them feel pretty good, right? Because they'd heard this before, but they'd have no clue that God's real sneaky here, and he's actually talking about something completely, he's talking about like something bigger than what he's done. And it's all led up to, as we know, eventually Jesus a couple hundred years later. So the root idea, though, really is more along the idea of being like restored. And there's root parts of this Teshua phrasing that really kind of is attached to like your health. And so like, so when we go all the way down into from, you know, Latin has a big bearing on our current language. Germanic, we come from Germanic, you know, English comes from a Germanic, you know, direct, you know, descendant, but Latin has a big part of things. And so the Latin really kind of took this idea and they used the word, like a word that's closely related to like salve. And we pronounce it salve. We don't really, people don't know what salve is anymore. No. Because it's like, what's salve? But, you know, back in the 50s, you probably would have known. And 60s maybe, but salve is basically Neosporin. Mm-hmm. You know, you get a cut, you put Neosporin on it. What's that Neosporin do? It helps you heal. And so that's crazy. Kind of the,
yeah. I had no idea that it was related to this concept.
Yep. Yep. And so the deeper meaning is restoration. It's not like a plane's crashing and Superman's coming to save you. God is really, at this point, he's trying to help reveal an idea that there's a deeper thing going on here. Of course, for them, they're thinking, this is great news. We're in a foreign territory. We've been captured. And they're probably thinking in their minds, cool, the glory days are going to be relived. And we're going to get a king again. We're going to have a temple again. We're going to have, you know, a great city again. We're going to be a big nation, a big deal again. We're going to relive those glory days. And really, God isn't really talking about the Superman coming to save in the day. God's actually talking about something's been broken and I'm going to restore it to full thing.
Yeah, it's crazy how it plays right into everything. Kind of points back to Genesis. At least the more I read into it, it seems like, and it's like, yeah, I mean, that was, you know, Genesis tells about the ideal that God created with Adam and Eve and kind of the ideal structure. And it's kind of a restoration to that type of thing. Us living in harmony with God, according to his purpose, in partnership with him, all of that. Yeah. Makes sense.
Yep. Yeah. And that would be because the slippery slope of the word salvation makes us think that, you know, we are crashing and burning and God is going to come like Superman and save the day. And it's easy to kind of fall into that because that's what salvation really kind of means to us today. It is a deliverance kind of thing, but we sometimes fail to see that deeper, you know, something's wrong and he's going to come and restore it back to it should have been.
We talk about it like that a lot. This idea that he's going to like pluck us up and take us somewhere away from here. Like I think of like, I'll fly away. It's like, that's the common understanding is that, God's going to sweep in and take us away from this current suffering. But I think the more accurate picture is he's going to restore here what he had originally intended all along.
Exactly. Yeah. Because if you do think about, God is not, if you're a Christian, you have to really start thinking in the ideals of plan, blueprint, strategy. And I know a lot of people don't think in that terms, but God is a very, very, very strategic God. And I think, to really kind of help understand deeper, because you're absolutely right. You know, from the very beginning, God had a blueprint. He had a plan. He didn't create human beings just because he was bored and thought, this will be fun. I mean, now giraffes, okay, sure, probably. He probably thought, hey, this would be cool. Check us out. With humans, though, there's an intentionality there that really is almost like the icing on the cake for God. And so because in human beings, there's a likeness, right, made in our likeness. And so the idea is that there's going to be a union here unlike any other union, right? There's going to be that's why we talk about ecclesia so much, is because ecclesia is the partnership. And so, you know, there's three parts to this overarching narrative here that flows throughout the whole Testament, New Testament. And those three parts are, you know, birth of a dream, death of a dream, resurrection of a dream, and AKA creation, the fall, and restoration back to creation. And it's all of that. And so that is actually the plan of salvation. And that is a real churchy phrase. I mean, we've heard that a lot growing up and stuff. But the plan of salvation, trying to get away from the churchy cheesiness of it, it really is a plan. God really does have a plan. He does have a plan to rescue and restore not just us, but all of creation, which is what Paul kind of talks about in Romans 8, which is an understanding of the deeper understanding of, hey, you know, this isn't just a God coming and saving human beings like Superman flying through the sky. Like, it's deeper than that. It's bigger than that. It's all of creation, because when humanity failed, creation failed. And so that's the kind of the deeper thing. I think we are not too much unlike the Old Testament Israelites in definitely thinking that, hey, you know, these are the glory days, and you know, really the, you know, this idea of partnership is, you know, where, you know, I'm going to do a couple of things and that's going to make God happy. And that's what our relationship's going to look like. You know, I'm going to do some things and it's going to make him happy. So I got to keep doing these things to keep him happy. And that's not what God was going for at all.
And that's the tension that I saw when I was reading in Philippians, because, you know, I was reading in Philippians right after I was coming off of Ephesians. We were studying Ephesians in my small group, and Paul talks about in Ephesians 2, I think he says something to the effect of, you know, it's through grace that you've been saved, not by your own doing, so that you can't boast. And it's kind of that talking about, hey, it's not your works that do anything to accomplish this salvation. It's through grace alone, through your faith in Jesus. And then I read in Philippians where he talks about, well, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. And my initial reaction, well, isn't that a contradiction? Where in Ephesians you're talking about there's you know, the works not playing into it, but then in Philippians you're talking about, you know, working out your salvation. So that was the initial tension that I saw.
And I think that is like the tag team wrestling partner of the concept of salvation, right? Is like works doesn't have any part of it. And, you know, when we lay it all out on the table, it really, it just ends up being a bunch of churchy words and phrases that we stumble through and just go, I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, I guess it kind of works kind of like the Trinity. I'll just trust it. I'll trust my pastor. I'll trust everybody or whatever. And okay, whatever. Even though it sounds a little weird, kind of controversial, or maybe, you know, that it contradicts itself. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that it really doesn't. So if we're looking at it, if we're taking that then at the idea that of what salvation really is, it's actually restoration. And the backing of that is like there's a plan behind it. Okay. Then when Paul does start talking about, you know, hey, these things were you can't earn it, really. You can't do enough to earn it. He's really kind of like talking the idea of like, hey, you know, you can't treat God like the old Testament Israelites did. You know, you don't go, hey, God, let me go over here and do all these sacrifices and have this huge, huge party for you, hoping, you know, that it changes your mind and you won't destroy us. And then what we're really trying to do is like almost manipulate God into moving. Right. We're trying to get him to move. We're trying to get him to come and initiate salvation.
Yeah.
And that's what Paul is talking about, because he says, listen, you can't initiate salvation.
Yeah.
He already did it.
Yeah. I think that's the distortion I had in my mind that I'm starting to realize was wrong, is this idea or this concept that salvation is something I'm striving towards, not something that has already happened. It's easy to get in this mindset that I need, now I'm a Christian, I need to live the rest of my life like a Christian in order to earn the salvation at the end of the day. But really, it's like you got to change your mind to realize that salvation has already occurred. As long as you believe in Jesus, the work has already been done by Jesus. And now working out your salvation is, like you said, it's more living in accordance like that is the truth, that in recognition that has already happened, and now we should live accordingly because it has already happened, more so than living in a way to try and earn that.
You know, something that I do, and I know you've heard me say this quite a bit, what I try to always do and teach from us with the ecclesia, the central point that I try to teach from as an illustration is a marriage. And it would be almost like your wife trying to do everything she possibly can do to get you to go and get a ring and ask her to marry you, right? She's doing all this stuff. And she's trying so hard. And to basically win your affection, to motivate you to take the initiative, even though she's taking the initiative, right? She's trying to get you to do something. And so our relationship, this ecclesia partnership thing with God, is exactly the same way. Matter of fact, God uses wedding analogies all the time. Jesus uses wedding analogies all the time. So if we look at it like that way, it's like God has already decided in his mind to start the engagement, right? You're too late. You can't go and manipulate him to do it. He already initiated the engagement, right? So that's really kind of what Paul is talking about. And in Philippians 2, actually Philippians 2 has, there's a ton of stuff up there, because in the top of Philippians 2, if you can, you scroll the top up there. Yeah. So how, see, he's starting the chapter here talking about Jesus. And as the heading there says, Christ's example, this is the way it's supposed to look like. And so he goes through all this stuff right here. And then he goes down towards the point. He says, and becoming, go to 14, or no, wait, I'm sorry. Go up, scroll up. It's right there at 8. Yeah, 8. And being found in human form, he humbled himself and becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. So the main point of all of this, of talking about Jesus being equal with God and was God, really is the idea that Jesus basically, you know, took his jersey off, right? So no one would recognize who he was. He would not recognize him as God. He became a human being. Why? For the point of obedience. So then you look down at the bottom down here. That's the example, okay? The top of that is the example. Here's your example. Now, let me tell you guys, beloved, you've always obeyed, but most of that's probably been when I've been around. So I want you to try to do that on your own. So you're going to have to, it's basically like saying, like, Brandon, you can't have your parents' faith. You got to have your own. Because the reality is that God here has initiated a rescue mission, a restoration mission, an engagement. He initiated it. It is for you. It's for me as well, but it's not for me. And then through me, it's for you. No, it's for you. And here's the deal. He's asking you, will you marry him?
Yeah.
And you said yes. Now, you know, you need to spend some time with the groom, right?
Yeah.
Because this is a relationship. And, you know, just like you with your wife, like me with my wife, with our spouses, you can't have a relationship with each other without actually trying to get to know each other. Actually, the funny thing is, in culturally, if you start reading and learning about the Jewish culture throughout the Old Testament, you'll quickly realize, since we're talking about wedding stuff here, that weddings were arranged.
Yep.
Right. So marriages were arranged. Now, they weren't like, oop, sick. That's weird. You're going to ship your daughter off to someone you don't know. Most of the time, they were people they knew very, very well. They were trying to strengthen, you know, family, you know, bonds, an extended family bond kind of stuff. So you knew this family probably pretty well, but maybe the kids, the groom and the bride, maybe they didn't know each other super well. So what happened? They agreed on an arrangement. The fathers met with their kids. They agreed on an arrangement. They went their separate ways. The groom went back with his dad and he started preparing a place. Heard that somewhere before in the New Testament. It took however long it took. His dad would end up looking at, and he would add on to his parents' house. His dad would then say, you know what? I think you're done. Go get your bride. And no matter what time of the day or whatever, they ventured over to the bride. And when they got to the bride, they had probably a week long, you know, celebration, a ceremony. And after that, they had an at least year long honeymoon. I mean, ours last like a week or two if we're lucky. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of people only have like a 2 or 3 day honeymoon. But the honeymoon process was a whole year, and primarily that whole process was just to get to know each other.
Yeah.
And this, to me, is exactly the same mentality. Working it out doesn't mean that you go and work on trying to get God's affection. No, they've already entered into the relationship. Paul is just saying, hey, it's time for you guys to start, you know, getting to know the groom on your own.
Yeah, I think it's the difference between if Paul had said work towards your salvation versus what he actually says, which is work out your salvation.
Yeah.
That's a key difference, I think.
Well, that's a point you're making. The one of the huge problems, you know, there's videos on TikTok and Instagram, and I'm sure you've seen them, of people like going through English words, you know, and it's a big joke because, you know, the word C-O-M-E has come, the word H-O-M-E is home.
Yeah. Yeah.
You change one letter and you change the sound of it.
Yeah.
It's are, you know, if we were looking at this in Hebrew or Greek or whatever, it wouldn't be that big of a deal. But since we're looking at it in English, and English can be seriously jacked up, difficult to get. That's why. And so we see work in two different places and we go, oh, they're the same. And the reality is, no, they're not. They're really, really not. And the thing is, like, when Paul talks about those kinds of things, or even James, and in James, I think it's chapter two. In chapter two, it talks about faith without works, right? So now you've got three different ways. Faith without works. How can you have faith without works? There's the same stupid word, work. The reality is you've got three complete different ways that they're supposed to be understood. And so, like, for that, it's really more about the idea of the fruit of your labor instead of labor. And the reality is the labor is your relationship. James, the writer of James, is saying, what's your fruit from that look like? Because if you don't have any kind of, just so like with you and your wife, James 2:14. Yeah. Yeah.
2:14. Yeah.
Yeah. This is where it starts. And then I can already hear, sounds good. Let's see. Yeah, there it is.
Yeah.
You can no more show me your works apart from your faith, and you can show me your faith apart from your works. Faith and works, works and faith, they fit together hand in glove. Speaking of the message. They do. It's just like a marriage. You listen, you have a bad marriage, it's going to show. You have a good marriage, it's going to show. And now, thinking of all that put together now, all three of those works things put together, and you go back to Philippians 2. Pull that up because it's really funny. Now that we know these three different things, we go back to Philippians 2. What's the heading of this part that we're wondering about here?
Lights in the world.
Lights in the world. Do all these things without grumbling or disputing in verse 14, since you may be blameless and innocent children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and twisted generation among whom you shine as lights of the world. That's Paul's point. Paul's point is, like, you know, referencing all the way back to Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, right? Supposed to be lights of the world. That's the point. And actually, a lot of theologians and scholars would say that was the point of Adam and Eve. Mm-hmm. So now we're looking at, this is what restoration looks like.
Yeah, makes sense. Here. Images of God. There's a point to
exactly.
The whole thing. Yep.
Exactly. So, you know, I get it. Again, I get it. You know, it's English and it's crazy. But really, it's probably super important just to gain some context on each one of these things and be able to, like, sort through. But again, if we can really look at both the Old Testament and the New Testament in the lens of a marriage, that this is what God's actually going for, then a lot of things start to become pretty clear.
So the other one was, now that we're to the point of saying that there's still an expectation on God's part of works, but not so much to earn salvation, but to be a light to the world, to show others that we are His images and stuff like that. It also brings to light, well, does that mean we have to like follow all of the law and stuff like that? I mean, it brings the law into it and this concept of being perfect. And that's where I had also read, and I think in Galatians, Paul talks about this idea that he's not calling us to be perfect. He's not even calling us to follow the law anymore. It's just that it's where you get into the fruits of the Spirit and mm-hmm. how those things are supposed to be evidence that you are living according to His purpose and design.
Like the law, you know, I love how N.T. Wright talks about the law. He talks about the law like guideposts. Now, we don't really understand what the heck guideposts are, but it'd be like, you know, driving an interstate and you see a sign that says Atlanta, 56 miles. Mm. Okay, I know where I'm heading in the right direction. Those signs really are pointing to something. We're not supposed to stop on the side of the road to get out of a car and worship those signs. Oh, man, look at this. It'd almost be like our equivalent to the Bible, kind of. Now, we'll get into that deeper some other time as well, but... Is the Bible, are we supposed to worship the Bible? No, we're supposed to, the Bible is just a guidepost leading us somewhere. And the same goes for like the Old Testament. Really, it's kind of the concept of God saying, okay, in the meantime, this isn't the end of the plan here, guys, but in the meantime, let me set up some guideposts here. Some very, very, because if you look at like the actual law, right, the Ten Commandments, mm-hmm. right, if you look at those things, they're really pretty basic.
Yeah.
Don't kill somebody. Most of these things should be a duh. But really, these are what's really happening in this moment is that God is, again, he's trying to reconnect with his bride. He's trying to get his bride to really start to know him. This is the honeymoon kind of a deal.
Yeah.
And there's a whole nother crazy section we can go on with wedding analogy throughout Exodus and them actually leaving Egypt. But primarily that's really what the law was set up to do. Because why? Because these people now, these Israelites, are not the same Israelites that entered into Egypt. They just, they honestly don't know God.
Yeah.
They don't know him. So really, this is just a, hey, here's some things we can set up to kind of help point you in the right direction. And so I think Paul, you know, when Paul talks about the law, he's really speaking to people who are Jews, to help them kind of like separate a little bit, right? And he's even kind of trying to do the same thing of saying, hey, you know, it's not about, you know, it's not about getting back to, you know, Jerusalem,
yeah.
right? It's not about that kingdom. It's really more about, because he now looks at and sees Jesus as the fulfillment of those laws. And when mm-hmm. we say fulfillment, it's like all those laws are pointing to Jesus. Yeah. Jesus is Atlanta. We're driving to Atlanta and we see all these signs. When we finally get there, yes.
We're in Atlanta.
That's it. We're in Atlanta. And then the other side of that is perfection, which is also another misconception of what that really means. Because the word perfection really actually means, the Greek there actually means completion.
Hmm.
And so when we think about a process of restoration,
yeah,
there is a point where it becomes complete.
Yeah.
And
the perfection came through Jesus, not through our, it all kind of ties together. Yeah, because what I was reading in Galatians, Paul says, mm-hmm. he's talking about, he says, let me ask you this question. Did you receive the Holy Spirit by obeying the law of Moses? Of course not. You received the Spirit because you believed the message you heard about Christ. After starting your new lives in the Spirit, why are you now trying to become perfect by your own human effort? Have you experienced so much for nothing? Surely it was not in vain.
Yeah. So these guys are trying to go back to. Here's another thing that's happening. What's actually happening in the Galatian Christian community there is that Paul went and established it, right? Because these people are not Jews.
Yeah.
They're not Jews. So what's happening is that Paul has established this you can say congregation if you want to, but this Jesus community. And so what's happened is after Paul has left, a delegation from Jerusalem came and said, hey, wait a minute. Have you all been circumcised?
Yeah, I was going to say, it looked a lot about circumcision.
Yeah. Most of that is all about circumcision. And this is where Paul actually goes and confronts Peter and some other guys and goes, you guys
are missing the point.
You still got a long ways to go. So what Paul is basically saying is like, I've already told you that all those things are leading to Jesus. Once you get to Jesus, you don't go backwards, you know, thinking that I've got to go and do these things. Once again, I got to go do things, you know, because if you understand the concept of Messiah, the Messiah concept, mm-hmm. whether it's Jesus or whoever you believe it to be, we believe it to be Jesus, obviously, but a Messiah concept is God with us.
Yeah.
And so therefore, not saying that all the stuff that they did in the Old Testament was no good anymore. It's not that. All that is the story. It's all leading. You know, you don't go and say, oh, we're at chapter 20. Now we got to go back to chapter 3 because chapter 3 is the ending. No.
Yeah.
It's leading somewhere.
To go back to your Atlanta example, it's not like you go you drive back down south and now you try and follow the guidepost again to go get to Atlanta. You're already in Atlanta.
You're
now
there.
Act like you're in Atlanta. That,
right.
That may be where this breaks down. I don't know what it means to act like you're in Atlanta.
Well, I mean, I don't think I want to know.
No.
So when you look at Philippians and you go working it out.
Yeah.
That's literally just, I mean, Paul probably said this stuff, probably said that same little phrasing or something similar to it. Like every community he started,
yeah.
if he would go back to them or write letters back to them or visit them again, he'd be like, guys, you can't have my faith. It doesn't flow through me. You got to go get him, know him yourself. And so I'm here to help you, but, you know, you're pretty much, this is between you and God, you know, and Jesus is the mediator. He's the guy that came and made it all possible. So, and ironically, in a crazy, weird way, Paul had to have the same conversation with Peter.
Yeah.
You know, but Peter got it.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter got it. And he was like, I think Peter had an aha moment at that point too, because Peter then, he came to Galatia and he was, matter of fact, they believe that he was crucified upside down in and around the Galatia area.
Really?
So that almost like became his home, really.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a cool little deal. It's so cool that Jesus actually picked Paul.
Yeah.
Because Paul was a Jew among Jews. He was a guy that had zeal. He knew a lot. He was super smart and he was living that life. And Peter and those guys really weren't. They were in the context of that world, but they weren't living that world. And so for Paul to see Jesus as the destination that everything that he knew of pointed to, because they believed that it pointed to a Messiah, obviously. But Jesus is it. So it's kind of cool to see how that all of that now completely really fits in. And it's not just it's not just something that Paul tells those guys. It's really something that really is very applicable for us today. You know, that we can't have a faith through our pastor. Mm-hmm. I don't think any pastor would ever tell you that, that you can have a faith through them. Now, sometimes the systems are set up that way.
Yeah.
We've talked about that before, but the reality is that, you know, you do not have a relationship with God through anything. Jesus is the direct link. You don't need anything else. That's kind of what's been going on there.
From the whole Rheology team, we hope these podcasts are encouraging and educational. Rheology exists for three main reasons: to reach, train, and equip those who want to go deeper with God in this partnership called Ecclesia. If God has been stirring in your heart, where you are wondering if there's more than what you've been experiencing in today's 21st century Christianity, we'd love to connect with you, to hear your story and help you know that you are not alone. You can simply contact us via the website, rheologylife.com, or reach out via Instagram @rheology_life. Thanks, and we'll see you next time.